Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Monday, April 22nd from HPR2. It's The Conversation. An Earth Day look at the ledge.
Hybrid help for authors footing the bill.
Free to be Urban Z or not.
Bound by time on paper and stage.
Plus the international report today from Deutsche Welle, making the first million in the backyard and a minimum for the maximum in the reality check. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Justice Department confirms that the surviving Boston terrorism suspect is charged with using a weapon of mass destruction. And White House spokesman Jay Carney says Jahar Tsarnaev will not be tried as an enemy combatant.
We will prosecute this terrorist through our civilian system of justice. Under U.S. law, United States citizens cannot be tried in military commissions.
Tsarnaev is a naturalized U.S. citizen. The 19-year-old and his older brother, Tamerlan, were born in southern Russia. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was killed in a police shootout last week. The younger suspect was seriously wounded, and he remains under armed guard at an area hospital. Massachusetts will hold a moment of silence later this hour for the three people who were killed and more than 180 wounded in the Boston Marathon bombings. The state will pause at 2:50 p.m. Eastern, the time of the first explosion, before bells toll across the state. Air travelers are bracing for more delays today thanks to the furloughs of air traffic controllers forced by the sequester budget cuts. All of the nation's nearly 15,000 air traffic controllers will lose one day of work every other week. NPR's Craig Windham reports the Federal Aviation Administration says the furloughs mean the will have to be scaled back.
Air traffic controller Victor Santori in Atlanta told WSB-TV the situation is similar to shutting down some toll booths on a busy highway.
If you have 10 toll booths and you can only open 8 of them, traffic's going to back up.
And Mike Foote, a spokesman for the National Association of Air Traffic Controllers, told KNBC-TV the delays could have a ripple effect.
You could be sitting on the ground at Los Angeles due to some controller in Cleveland not being able to get to work today because he was furloughed.
The FAA estimates the worst delays could reach about an hour at Los Angeles and the New York area airports, 2 hours at Chicago's O'Hare, and more than 3 hours at Atlanta's busy Hartsfield International. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Existing home sales dipped in March. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports the National Association of Realtors says the constraint of having too few homes on the market held sales down.
The number of completed transactions dropped 0.6% in March, but that's not a reflection of buyer interest, which the Realtors Association says is up 25% from last year. But there are few homes to buy. The number of homes for sale increased slightly during the month, but remains below what market experts say is a normal level of inventory. The result is that buyers are bidding up prices. The average price of a single-family home is now nearly 12% higher than it was this time last year, and that is the strongest monthly price increase in 7.5 years. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Dow's down 11 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, sponsor of the Zurich Classic Golf Tournament in New Orleans, April 25th through April 28th.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. A week from Thursday, legislative session 2013 is scheduled to end, and by then, its definitive character will be set. On this Earth Day, a look at how environmental bills have fared. Lele Shi works with the Surfrider Foundation and the Sierra Club and shares the legislative portal, Capital Watch Hawaii. She's here this morning with an overview of what's left and what went by the wayside. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Well, I mean, literally today we're seeing a couple of these environmental bills that will be in conference.
Yes.
But let's just start with some of the big hits. I mean, some of the big hits you might put with maybe the PLDC.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the big environmental successes this year, I would say, would be repealing the PLDC. So the PLDC was created in 2011, and it would have given broad exemptions from land use regulations and the environmental review process for these development projects. And this upset a lot of people. And
we've covered a lot of that, so forgive me, but our time with you is short. Yeah. But now we have perhaps the son of PLDC, the triple PA,
yes,
which is still a bargaining chip.
Yeah, it's a, kind of a watered down of the PLDC. It's not quite as bad. There's a lot more limited authority, but it definitely is of concern. It would kind of act as a bargaining chip because there's word at the Capitol that this might be passed in exchange for SB 1087, which would create green financing options for renewable energy.
And 1087, when Cisco DeVries was here, we talked about that because he's been pushing bills like this all over the country, although this would be very much a benchmark for Hawaii. That's going to be heard this afternoon.
This will be heard this afternoon, too, and this would be important because this would create opportunities for folks at all income levels to put renewable energy on their houses, and this would be a safe, secure way of funding it at low interest rates.
Now, some of the things that you wanted to have happen, like the styrofoam bills, and there were a little triad of those, mm-hmm, didn't really happen, but sort of UH picked up, and at least with its initiative, will,
yes,
be doing a little bit of what you'd like to see happen.
Exactly. So it was a disappointment. The three styrofoam bills at the legislature didn't go anywhere, but at UH we actually just passed policy that would ban styrofoam across campus, and this policy actually took effect just last week, and it applies to all vendors who will have to renew their contracts, and they'll have to use materials that aren't styrofoam and are encouraged to use eco-friendly products instead.
Well, we're talking the good, the bad, and the maybe. What about the solar? The situation with solar. We've got one bill that's going to be heard this morning.
Yes. So this would be the reduction of the solar tax credit.
623.
SB 623. So this has been an important bill because the solar tax credit has incentivized a lot of people to put renewable energy on their houses, but it's not sustainable for the solar. For the state budget, for the tax revenue that we generate. So it has to be reduced, but it needs to be reduced gradually because I think people won't be able to afford or won't be interested in installing solar if it just drops too dramatically. So instead, this would be a gradual reduction of the tax credit that will still allow people to get a generous tax credit and find the time to do so.
Some of the other things that have sort of gone by the wayside, the one that died last month that would have allowed a new definition for fossil fuel, SB 17, that sort of just stalled.
Unfortunately, the liquid natural gas bill, this would have extended the barrel tax to liquid natural gas and to coal. And what's interesting about this one is that at first the gas companies actually supported putting the tax on liquid natural gas and coal because that would be fair to treat it as a source of carbon. But at the last minute in the Committee of Energy and Environmental Protection, the lobbyists from the gas companies actually flipped their stance on this 100% and decided that they no longer supported this bill. And unfortunately, the committee didn't have enough votes to move it, so it died. It's very unfortunate.
What hasn't died, though, is SB 15, the ethanol bill.
Right. So at first, that one required that 10% of gas be made of ethanol, and then that switched to 10% biofuel. However, this didn't quite make sense because we don't actually produce biofuel in Hawaii at the time, and also probably engines can't handle them.
Well, that's the big question. Why? Why the change in language?
Well, it's actually a good thing. So the House actually changed the language and turned it into a task force to examine the feasibility of this.
So we can study it.
like we
study everything.
I know. So a lot of times these task forces are kind of like a dismissive action. But in this case, our engines can't actually support biofuels at the time. So it's not too bad. But there will be a tax credit for folks who do make biofuel. And this would be $15 million a year would be allocated to this tax credit. So there is actually something concrete about it.
On the disappointment side, the bag bill.
Right. So the bag bill is something that environmental groups have been trying to move for a few years now. And this last year, it would have funded the Watershed Initiative, which we all know is incredibly important. It's the key to our future water supplies. So basically, a small fee on all bags would have gone to fund the Watershed Initiative. And there was another vehicle to raise this funding as well, which was the conveyance tax. Unfortunately, both bills died pretty early on.
But the good news is the watershed's going to get some money. Not a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe $2.5 million a year, but not a lot.
Exactly. Fortunately, it got worked into the general fund, the budget. So they'll be getting $2.5 million a year from the general fund for the next 2 years. So at least there's that.
Looking at all of these bills, Lele, if you had to characterize this session as being somewhat environmentally friendly, greatly environmentally friendly, where do you put it on that continuum?
You know, I would say that with the PLDC, that was a great success. But with conference committee happening this year, Earth Week, by the way, it definitely has the potential to be a great environmental year. If we could see the solar tax credit moving, if we could see the funding mechanisms for green projects moving, then I think we could actually have a phenomenal environmental year.
Thanks for coming in with the overview.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Lele, she's on the executive committee of Surf Rider Foundation and Sierra Club Oahu. She's also the chair of Capital Watch Hawaii. That's a portal into the Hawaii legislative process for anyone interested in following environmental bills. Several are still moving, including later on today. This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. After the quiz, we check out what's brewing in IAEA, self-publishing moves on, and a low-end hike that probably won't make a difference. Right now, let's chant.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohangai.
Hawaii tourism had a banner year in 2012. Nearly 8 million visitors visited our home, and that's an almost 10% gain over 2011, breaking the pre-recession record of 7.6 million visitors reached in 2006. The growing good news continues this year. Last month, Hawaii Tourism Authority announced a hike in its projections for this year and now expects to welcome a record 8.5 million visitors and $15.8 billion in spending. Also, according to HTA, for the first 2 months of 2013, arrivals to Kauai led the visitors per island, growing a whopping 10% over 2012. Modern tourism got its start with the advent of commercial jet service in 1959, and today, our backyard quiz question for you. In what year did Hawaii first welcome its millionth visitor? And for bonus points, how many years did it take for the visitor count to double to 2 million?
Mondays mean putting an ear to the conversation at a local coffee spot. Today, Bill Sage is at Kapi'olani Coffee Shop in IAEA to find out what's brewing. Morning, Bill.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Out here at the Kapi'olani Coffee Shop, we have three people sitting in with us today. We have Gary, we have Susan, and we have Robert. Now, Gary, we're going to lead off with you because you were saying some things which really interested you. We started talking about the bombing, and you were saying things that really interest you, though, are U.S. military spending. What's going on with that?
Well, I want to know why we spend roughly about 46% of the world's defense budget. And I think we don't spend enough money for our children, education and social issues. And I was born in Okinawa, and I don't know why we spend so much money having 50,000 soldiers in Okinawa. And I think somehow our budget, I think we should balance more on social issues and education. Instead of spending too much on guns, we should spend more on butter. And that's how I feel about it.
Okay, so guns and butter in Hawaii. Do you think that Hawaii itself, I know we got a big military presence here in the island, do you think it should be more balanced with local education?
That's the money for the military here, it comes from the federal government, so it doesn't affect us as much. But the money, the federal money we spend overseas, amounts to 46% of the world's budget. For example, China spends roughly 4.8% of the world's defense budget. And yet, you know, every time China spends 1% more, we say, whoa, we better watch out. Well, we spend 46%, you know.
And we get most of our stuff from China anyway. Thank you very much, Gary. Susan, you are here today in this beautiful coffee shop. You're smiling at me. So what's uppermost on your mind today?
I don't know. I was just listening to what Gary was saying about spending. My husband is ex-military. I do believe in education, and I think we should spend a lot of money on education and then taking care of the local people. As far as defense-wise, I know it's important because we need them to protect our country. I don't really know how much millions of dollars they spend, but maybe it's something that could be compromised in some way where most of the spending should be spread out, I think. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense to me. Thank you very much for talking with us. And Robert, briefly, we got about 40 seconds left. You think that the North Korean problem is more talk and bluster than an actual problem?
I guess it's more on the young leader, Kim Jong-un, want to get a loyalty from the people. So he's a young, so I guess he saw when his father took the power, he did the similar things. So he want his show his power to his people domestically. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Robert. So out here at the Kapi'olani Coffee Shop in Aiea, not the Aiea Coffee Shop in Kapi'olani, we have lots of opinions about everything from Korea to the military budget to taking care of education, and we'll be taking care of your coffee scene. So if you got a cup for us, we'll be out there to see you. Thank you so much. Back to you, Beth Ann, in the studio.
Time was, an author who wanted to reach the public had to pass through a narrow gateway, winning acceptance by one of a dozen or so publishing houses, and through it, distribution in bookstores and reviews in mainstream publications. Self-published works were derided as vanity projects. There's a new and welcome paradigm these days, a kind of balancing act between the highly curated product of established publishing houses and the anything-goes approach. Watermark Publishing is creating a new imprint for a new approach to self-publishing, and Dawn Sakamoto is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Dawn. Thank you.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you so much for having me here.
You know, if I've, you know, typical author with a manuscript and wants to get it out, I mean, essentially what I want as an end product is I want people to be able to find it, right?
Right, right. That's what we see a lot. We have people who say, oh, I've got this story that I want to tell, and how do I get it out there? So that need has tended to range anywhere from, well, I just want to share it with my family and my friends. I'm not looking to be the next big thing, so we can help them with that. And there are, of course, clients who come to us saying, well, I want to make sure it's on every bookstore, although these days that's, you know, rarer and rarer. But they want to be able to have a product that, you know, perhaps they could sell themselves online or distribute through Amazon, and we help them with that as well.
If your goal is to be the next big thing, you're going to want to get reviewed in the New York Times. You're going to want to get distributed at, you know, bookstore chains and things like that. And that tends to send people toward the, you know, the publishing houses that have been around for a long time.
Right. So the publishing world is changing a lot. You know, you hear these days about the self-publishing successes. You know, E.L. James and 50 Shades of Grey, of course, is the big latest buzz on that. And she started out as fanfic, and she published that herself. Of course, while that self-publishing, people are starting to notice it more and more, you notice that also her success came when she did work with a traditional publisher, and she's now got it all over the place. You can't escape that thing, can you?
And that success came in part because of access to distribution and reviews, right?
Right. So what she had done was she did this on her own. She published it, and it started to get noticed. There's a lot of word of mouth, which is, you know, these the critical review is wonderful because it means that a voice that people trust, or whose opinion at least they know, where they come from, what kind of things they like, people can go out and see that someone like that has said, well, this, that, or the other thing about the book.
Mm-hmm.
But word of mouth is so incredibly powerful these days. You know, you go on Facebook, you see what your friends like, and you know exactly what their taste is like.
Mm-hmm.
So if they recommend something to you, that's extremely powerful. So for an author to put something out there and to know, we offer the service to ensure that what they're putting out is quality. Because even if your friend loves you to death, you know, if you're book is spelled atrociously and makes no sense at all, even they're going to have a hard time saying, well,
sure,
Chris, that's a great book. So we help the author with that to ensure that they're putting out something that's quality, because that is, as you said, it used to be called vanity publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a lot of input. The person went ahead and they just kind of ran with whatever they decided to put down on paper.
Mistakes and all.
Mistakes and all, exactly. So that is where Legacy Isle comes in, where the self-publishing world, it's the wild, wild west. If you go to Amazon, they have CreateSpace. There are companies like Author House or Lulu, and you can put your manuscript up there. You can make it available. There are options through them to get it into bookstores and all of that kind of thing. Everybody offers these services. We don't offer them the most inexpensively, but that's because we're also providing locally an editor to look at it, copy editor, production, design, printing, all of that. So we're your one-stop shop. We take care of all of that, and there's a real person looking at it.
Donna, is it your experience that no one is his own best editor?
Absolutely. You know, everybody needs someone to look at it. You can't write a good book in
a
vacuum.
And not somebody you know.
No, not somebody you know, because, you know, they never want to hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of people who come and they say, well, you know, I wrote this story. Oh, well, okay, that's nice. And everybody says it's really great. Well, how many people is everybody?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you ask your mom, of course, she thinks your mud pies were great. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So you can't, at a very minimum, you need to have a professional copy editor look at it. You need to have someone say, gosh, Chris, you know, when you say this, I don't understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And your friends might not want to say that because maybe they don't want to look ill-informed. Maybe they don't, you know, want to hurt your feelings. So you do need that person to look at it.
Well, you know, when you've written a manuscript a couple hundred pages and you're so completely immersed in it.
Yes.
That, you know, you can refer to something and you think, well, everybody knows that because it's part of so much a part of your life.
Exactly.
Right?
You've internalized it. It makes complete and total sense to you. But, you know it forwards and backwards, whether it's a piece of fiction that you created, which actually, incidentally, we don't publish fiction, or if you're explaining business concepts. You need to make sure that your reader can understand that, because if your readers don't understand that, you won't have any readers. No one will buy your book, and you don't want that.
Well, given that you do nonfiction, Dawn, that brings in a whole fact-checking aspect,
right?
Doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the authors are responsible for their own fact-checking. You know, if we did see something that seemed a little ludicrous, we would obviously say, mm-hmm. well, you know, are you sure that that's the correct fact. Maybe you added an extra zero in
but
there.
But you do have to take that from your perspective. You have to take that on faith.
Right, exactly. The author is the expert on the topic, not ourselves. Just as in traditional publishing. You know, we do publish books and we always say, you know, ultimately, it's the author who's putting themselves out there. It's their name on the front of that book saying that I'm standing behind these facts. We're simply their way to get their message out there.
And that's the goal. That very definitely is.
So it is.
Thanks very much, Dawn,
for coming on the show. Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Good to have you. Dawn Sakamoto is Director of Sales and Marketing for Watermark Publishing and its new imprint, Legacy Isles Publishing. And you can learn more about both houses on our HPR website.
Breaks, you want to hear the story, then you want to talk about it. I'm Neil Conan. Talk of the Nation provides you with the latest news and analysis and a chance to share your experiences. For intelligent discussion about the day's happenings, join us on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
This program is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio's members, volunteers, and community partners. Special thanks to J.J. Dolan's Royal Hawaiian Center and the Rosalie M. Pressing Trust for their generous support of Challenge 2013. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:26. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Beginning this week, Hawaii lawmakers will decide whether the lowest paid workers in the most expensive state in the nation should be paid more for their labor. But can anyone in Hawaii really live on almost $19,000 annually? CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's harsh reality check. Good morning.
Yes, it is a harsh reality to live on $19,000 a year in Hawaii, nay, is it not?
Well, And the question is really, to anyone who is making less than that now, a little better than $15,000, certainly $19,000 looks, anything would look good. But is it realistic, and does it have so many unintended consequences that it may disincentivize those who would potentially offer other jobs or be able to somehow not give enough money all the way around to some minimum wage workers who might not necessarily be affected?
Now, it's been, I mean, these are the kind of things that lawmakers are going to have to wrestle with this week. It's conference committee at the legislature. The minimum wage increase proposal is on the table. On the pro side, folks say it's long overdue. It hasn't been raised in 6 years. It's currently $7.25 an hour. It's time to raise that and give people not only a chance to make a living, but also to have a little dignity. On the other side, primarily from businesses, they're saying, well, wait a minute, this is going to be harmful. We're already overburdened by high operating expenses here. The economy really is still in recovery mode. Don't raise it to $9 or $9.25 an hour. So this is a real tough one for the legislature.
And especially when you're talking about the hospitality industry, when we were talking to one head of a restaurant group saying, you know, we're talking about the difference between what the front of the house folks may get and the back of the house, because the front of the folks have, you know, the tips involved. And if we have to pay a higher rate on the tip tax, that's also going to play into this. And we're not talking enough about the fullness of this whole bill to raise the minimum wage.
Correct. And that's also language to that effect is in the bill, although they have not filled in the pukas. You know, really, we talk about a reality check here. It was interesting that so much of the testimony focused on how difficult it is to live here in Hawaii. I mean, think about it. If you're making $15,000 a year, that's barely going to cover rent. We've already, if even that, we've got the highest food costs, transportation costs. I already mentioned housing. I think the real question is this even enough, even if it is $9 or $9.25 an hour? Tough decisions for lawmakers this week, Beth Ann.
And it's going to be a tough situation for anybody, whether this happens or it doesn't happen. We're still talking about trying to make it in Hawaii under $20,000 each year.
I can't do it.
There are not a lot of people who can, which is maybe why we have so many people still living with their parents. But that's a whole other subject. Thanks, Jack.
We'll and lots of homeless people, too, on the street. Don't forget that.
Well, and that's the unfunny side of it. But looking at how this is going to go forward and what we do at this point, because there's only so much that we can do.
Exactly.
We're going to continue on and have this conversation again. Thanks so much. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, you're going to be talking about head injuries.
Yes, we are. We're going to talk about how do you know if that little bump on your head you can just ignore, or if it's a sign of something more serious you have to watch out for.
There's a pretty heavy price to pay for ignoring something serious, isn't there?
Well, there can be, and now some new studies are looking at really long-term effects of having more than one or two concussions. Can this affect kids with schoolwork? Can it actually affect people in their memory later? So we're going to talk about what these little bumps and scratches on your head might mean 10, 20 years later.
Well, they've been doing, as you know, Kathy, the studies they've done with retired NFL players who've been getting a lot of little bumps over the years, and it's not pretty 20 years later for them, is it?
Well, it really isn't. And in that particular scenario, you're looking at, you know, someone with high velocity, high speed head injuries. And these are things that generally may happen in a more professional environment with sports. But, you know, some of these head injuries can occur with some of our high school football players.
Sure.
And we're going to talk about what happens when somebody actually has a brief moment or two of loss of consciousness. And when should that take them out of the game? And when should they seek medical attention and get scans and all those sorts of things that hopefully will help keep them healthy?
Because it may be more than just getting your bell rung in a game. It could be serious stuff. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University. The HPU Symphonic Band presents Heavy and Light, From William Byrd to David Bowie, a community concert, 7 p.m. this Saturday at Roosevelt High School Auditorium, hpu.edu/springconcert.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We've got Sean Lotch from the Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo on the line. He's our official conduit to the research community at Mauna Kea Summit. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are some of the things we'll be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. Full moon takes place on Thursday this week, and on that evening, it will rise in the east at sunset and set in the west at sunrise. That same evening, Saturn will be about 4 degrees above it in the night sky, so a great chance to catch it as well. Jupiter is high in the western sky at sunset, and if you're an early morning riser, you can try catching a glimpse of Mercury in the eastern sky. It will rise around 5 a.m.
When it comes to things like the International Space Station or the Tiangong-1, anything observable this week?
Tonight, you can see the Tiangong-1 from 7:34 to 7:39 p.m., moving from west to south. The International Space Station actually makes two bright passes this week. See the first one Saturday evening from 8:15 to 8:18, moving from northwest to north. And the second one Saturday evening from 7:25 to 7:30 p.m., moving from north to east. Also, today is actually a historic day. Back in 2010, this was the first time that the X-37B was launched. While it's not visible this week, we will see it again in May.
And we know that you'll tell us when we can look for it.
Most definitely.
You did tell me that you're going to be telling us about a discovery of sorts.
Yes, the Kepler mission announced the discovery of three new planets that are nearly Earth's size and orbit their stars in what's known as the habitable zone. That's basically the distance from a star where water could exist in liquid form on the surface, which is really key for life. Kepler-62 is a system of five planets located about 1,200 light years away. Its planets, 62E and 62F, are 40% and 60% larger than the Earth. And Kepler-69 is a two-planet system located roughly 2,700 light-years away, and its planet, 69c, is about 70% larger than Earth. So all three of those planets just mentioned are actually the correct distance from their stars where they could have conditions favorable for life. And that's always something we're looking for when we're exploring for those exoplanets.
Well, let's hope there's something there, or maybe not.
Well, they're quite a ways away, so no worrying about them traveling here if they are.
We appreciate the heads up. Thanks, Sean.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You're quite welcome. Sean Lotch, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. So catch you next time here on Stargazer.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Coming up, sending Mr. Keynes home and journalists caught in a time warp. First, global events from Deutsche Welle.
DW Deutsche Welle. News.
This is Andy Valver in Bonn. Police in the United States say the brothers suspected of being behind last week's bombings at the Boston Marathon may have been planning other attacks. 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev was killed in a gunfight with police on Friday following a manhunt that shut Boston down. He and his younger brother, 19-year-old Jokar, are suspected of carrying out the attack last week that left three dead and 180 injured. Jokar Tsarnaev is in serious condition in hospital and unable to talk to investigators. They are unsure when he'll be well enough to speak to a top U.S. interrogation group who plan to question him. Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis has told the CBS News Network that authorities found a number of homemade explosives following Friday's shootout, leading them to believe the brothers may have been preparing another attack. Human Rights Watch on Monday accused authorities in Myanmar, including senior Buddhist monks, of organizing a campaign of ethnic cleansing against the country's Rohingya Muslim minority. The New York-based rights group says ethnic Rakhine nationalists from a powerful political party in western Rakhine State, along with senior Buddhist monks, encouraged coordinated attacks on Muslim neighborhoods. The group also said that while state security forces sometimes intervened to protect fleeing Muslims, more often they either stood idly by or participated directly in atrocities. A Rakhine State government spokesman denied the allegations. German airline Lufthansa canceled nearly all of its flights for early in the coming week on Saturday as it anticipated the effects of a planned strike. Of 1,720 flights planned for Monday, the company said only 32 were now scheduled to fly. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.de. I'm Andy Valver, Deutsche Welle News.
Depending on your perspective, Hawaii is either not using its prime ag lands for the best and greater good, or it's doing a respectable job of it. Recently, Cato Institute senior fellow Randall O'Toole paid Hawaii a visit, albeit with a little criticism in his outlook. Hawaii can use its land to the highest purpose, he says. All we have to do is leave it to the free market. I asked him how that reconciles the tension between ag land conservationists and housing developers in a small island state.
Well, you look at Hawaii and it looks finite, but the reality is there's lots of land in Hawaii. There's lots of land in Rhode Island. There's lots of land in Holland, which is one of the densest countries in the world. It's far denser than China, for example. So there's land everywhere, and land actually can be used for a lot of different purposes. So land that you might not think of as being ag land today because it's too steep or something, you go to Asia and they're terracing lands just like that and growing crops on them. And so there's really no shortage of land in Hawaii. What there is artificial shortages created by these government restrictions. And the artificial shortages have made housing so expensive. A balance, I think, would be found, I believe, in markets. I think a balance would be found by letting the market work, and land would be put to its highest and best use, whether that's for farming or for tourism or for housing or for factories or whatever. Housing does not take a lot of space, but it's very easy to restrict the market and make housing very, very expensive. if you relaxed these rules, you could devote a small percentage of Hawaii's land to housing. You'd probably end up with no less potential agricultural productivity, but you would end up with a lot more affordable living conditions for the people of Hawaii.
There's a great deal of fear around that, that if somehow we were to relax regulations, that we would be overrun with developers. And there are many people who have pointed to parts of the island that have been just summarily overdeveloped, and we don't have the infrastructure for that. And also, you know, looking at, well, can we really have enough housing for the people who really need it at an affordable level, and not just housing that's available for those who can afford to pay upwards of, you know, $600,000 for a single-family home, particularly on Oahu. How do you look at us and say that this is possible? On what sort of economic basis do you say that we can create a situation by relaxing the rules and wind up with more affordable housing?
Well, people do fear what could happen if they lose control. And yet, when they exercise that control, as I've said, they do more harm than good. And yet, we use markets every day. We go into a grocery store, and you don't see people protesting because they're selling meat and the vegetarians don't want them to sell meat. The vegetarians have their parts of the grocery store to go to. The vegans have their parts of the grocery store to go to. You don't see people protesting because too much milk is being made into ice cream and not enough is being made into cottage cheese. Those decisions get made by the market. You decide you want to pay so much for ice cream, so much for cottage cheese, so much for milk. If they offer it to you at a price you're willing to pay, you buy it. If you don't, if they don't, you skip that and buy a substitute, yogurt instead of cottage cheese. And it works very well, and it's transparent. You see the prices, and yet nobody has to be in charge. There's nobody in control of everything that's going on. The dairies, the manufacturers, everybody has a little piece of the picture that they see, and it all adds up to a system that works with incredible precision and diversity. It struck me when the Soviet Union fell that we had grocery stores in the United States that have 100,000 different food products on their shelves. The average is about 20,000 to 30,000. Just before the Soviet Union fell, their average grocery store had less than a dozen products on their shelves because people were trying to control everything. And by trying to control it, they ended up destroying it.
A grocery store, though, seems different from a housing development. So help me with this, because for developers who look at the land and they're looking at their bottom line and want to make a profit, and that means they need to charge what they feel they need to charge for a house, and we have people who are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 and still can't afford to buy a house, what do we do about them?
The reason they can't afford to buy a house is because of the land use regulations that have made housing so artificially expensive. If you go to California, you find exactly the same thing, even though California is a huge state that has an abundance of land. If you go to Texas, where they don't have these land use regulations, you can buy houses for under $20,000. You can buy three-bedroom, two-bath houses for under $60,000. You can buy brand new three-bedroom, two-bath houses for $110,000. So if you insist on a new house, you pay a little more. But you can buy a used house, you can buy a smaller house, you have an enormous range of choice, and people of all incomes can afford housing.
But you're talking about some pretty big states there. Texas is pretty big. California certainly is. You can drive a little further to get a house that's a little less expensive. We don't have that option.
Actually, you do. You know, Texas is big, but all of the urban areas in Texas only occupy a very tiny percentage of the state because housing doesn't take up that much room. There's this idea that single-family housing is really land-consumptive, but it isn't. Most of our cities are made up of industrial, streets, parks, commercial, and so on. In a typical city, only about a third of the land is residential housing. So right now, about 8% of Hawaii has been developed. And if you relaxed all of these rules and let people live the way they want to live and find affordable housing, it might go up to 10%. It might possibly go up to 12%. It probably won't go up that high. But Letting people live the way they want to live gives people choices. It makes things affordable, and it creates a balance between housing and agriculture and other purposes of the land.
Randall O'Toole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Randall O'Toole is a Cato Institute Senior Fellow. His analysis of urban land use and transportation issues is detailed in his book, The Best Laid Plans. In it, O'Toole calls for repealing federal, state, and local planning laws and proposes reforms that he says help solve social and environmental problems without heavy-handed government regulation. More about it is on the website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, my name's Jeff Wong, and I'm a b-boy and a student choreographer at UH Manoa for the Fall Footholds concert this year. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
This morning, we sang some of the praises of Hawaii's tourism industry, its record-breaking year of 2012, and the increase in projections for this year. That estimate now sits at 8.5 million people expected to spend $15.8 billion. But once upon a time, Hawaii was chasing its very first million visitors, and today we asked you to name the year. For extra credit, we also asked the number of years it took until the visitor count doubled and hit 2 million. On the brink of the 1960s, jet plane travel rapidly accelerated the appeal and the ease of visiting the islands, and in 1967, Hawaii marked its first million visitors. Only a few years later, in 1972, it doubled, and then it took only another 4 years to triple to 3 million visitors in 1976. That's today's quiz. Send yours to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Photographers have that ability to make time stand still, and the images linger in the mind long afterwards. For photojournalists, these images can be haunting and difficult to erase when the workday is over. Donald Margulies' play, Time Stands Still, looks at the private lives of a pair of journalists and examines the way the stories they cover affect them. Christine always plays one of the play's lead characters, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And you're a photographer in the play, right?
Yes.
And your husband is a print reporter?
Yes, he's a journalist, and I'm a photojournalist.
What kind of stories are you covering?
We're out in the war. We're on the front lines. We're up close to the most gruesome atrocities. And it's a contemporary play, so you can imagine what that looks like in Kandahar and Kabul a few years ago. He at one point has to leave the front line because he's seen too many atrocities, whereas I stick it out and stay until I am injured and have to come home.
There's a huge burnout risk to covering war zones and atrocities, as you describe, isn't there?
Yes, especially if your heart is functioning.
Yeah, exactly. And how do you deal, how does your character deal with images, in your case, images that tear at the heart?
She doesn't talk about it very much, but you can sort of surmise that she's a pretty tough person, and she's had to turn off certain emotional capacities in order to continue this line of work. And for her, the camera is the ultimate extension of herself. And when she has the camera up in front of her face, time stands still, and nothing around her exists. And I think that allows her to photograph what she photographs, because it's not her actively carrying out this sort of passive act in the face of violence, but it's her capturing truth.
That thing of where you sort of persuade yourself that you are floating free in a sea of ugly things around you, but you have a kind of purity to your function?
Yes, and at one point she does say that, you know, the camera has to be there to capture truth because the world needs to know what's happening.
Well, given that, I mean, and you're talking about a character who's got a lot bottled up inside, right?
Yes, I would imagine.
So, I mean, for you as an actor, that, you know, you can't convey all of that through the lines, can you?
No, but, you know, it's an incredible cast of four key roles. It's a four-person play, and the other three are very important in helping sort of set things up and in, you know, carrying the storyline forward. My character actually talks much less than the others.
Mm-hmm.
The boyfriend, the photojournalist, is very verbose and emotional, and her former boyfriend, the photo editor, is a really interesting character with a potty mouth and, you know, a lot of big ideas about things. So the other characters are very important, actually, in the storyline.
Do you have some of the sort of mordant humor of the news newsroom?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. My mom saw the show and said, "Boy, I really didn't like her at times."
Yeah.
You know, she's not always the sort of warm and fuzzy person.
Well, when you're in that world as a journalist, you can find yourself carrying around a lot of information in your head that makes you hard to like.
Right. You know that, having done it yourself.
Having been hard to like, yeah.
Well, I don't know that you're hard to like, but, yeah, I mean, I think you have to be able to separate. Otherwise, you can't carry on. You have to put up that wall.
Yeah, you just have to recognize that the things you carry in your head are not for civilian consumption, that they're things you can only talk about with the other members of your tribe. Is that kind of how she is?
Yeah, but she doesn't really have other members of her tribe in her immediate Brooklyn apartment surroundings, which is where the play takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually adds to the tension of the dynamic, that she doesn't have a direct ally. Her boyfriend, the journalist, the print journalist, has a very different sensibility. And her editor is a wonderful editor, but he also sort of thinks she's an idiot for going back to the front line over and over.
So in a way, her character is defined by the way people react to her in a four-character
Yeah,
play.
To some extent, I think. But, you know, the beauty of this play is it's timeless. It could take place, you know, tomorrow as well as 20 years ago when Vietnam War, you know, was so important because of the photos that were brought back and how it changed how we see war. So I think it is a timeless play. The characters are all incredibly interesting, all four of them, even the girlfriend Mandy, who's sort of the naive philosopher among the four callous older folks.
So without, you know, directly showing battle and things like that, how much are you able to convey about the horror of war, about what your character sees? It's sort of an indirect perspective, I would think.
There are a number of times when characters in the play do hold forth and describe the atrocities of war in gruesome detail, I think in order to bring the audience into their heads a bit.
So, and that's likely to take people to a place where characters are not entirely sympathetic, right? You have to create some, and yet you can't have a character, nobody can create a character that's entirely unsympathetic, right?
Well, one would hope that the characters all have, you know, some amount of sympathy that the audience will pick up on. I think the other three are certainly very sympathetic. I think Sarah is a little tougher, you know, but she does have her moments, and there is humor in the play. Not gallows humor so much as just sort of how people interact and the humor of life and daily scenarios.
What are the characteristics in Sarah that would sort of draw you toward her?
I found it to be an extremely powerful female role. She's a feminist. She's, you know, very tough. She feels like she has a mission in life, which will lead her on and on and on until it kills her or something changes, maybe. But she's a unique female role, which attracted me. She's strong. She's international. She has a calling. And she has three incredible characters in her life, you know, who are just as important to the play. And so a good play has that dynamic of great characters interacting in an interesting way.
Is it necessary for an actor to really find, to sort of love the person she's playing in order to really represent her properly?
I think you have to find the character interesting enough to pull you in, and I am very intrigued by her. I've been around the world. I've seen things. I've never been in a war, but I've been in situations where tanks were in the streets, and mm-hmm. To do that, especially as a woman, which is a very non-traditional role for a woman. Mm-hmm. Even now, even today, you have very few female photojournalists covering the war. And those that are there are often, pulled under the wing of soldiers or sort of treated differently, mm-hmm. and they have to really fight against that in order to be taken seriously.
Thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Christine Always plays a photojournalist in the Hawaii Repertory Theater production of Time Stands Still. She'll have its final performance April 28th at 3:30 at the Kuananakoa Backstage Theater in Nu'uanu, and more about it is on our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travassa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travassa.com/Hana.
On The Next Humankind...
One choice started with environment, led to health, health led to an improvement, and the great thing about this is that they're interwoven. What's good for the environment is also seems to be the healthy choice as well.
The surprising link between global warming and what you eat.
Next time on Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace. Support for today's programming comes from The Shen Yun Show, an international touring classical Chinese dance performance with a live orchestra, coming to the Blaisdell Concert Hall May 3rd through 5th. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com.
We started the show talking about some of the environmental bills that either are making it through a conference or died along the way. I mean, seems to be the thing to do on an Earth Day where we're looking at how good we are to our part of the planet or not. And it looks like if you had to weigh it on one side or the other, a little bit better than other years.
A little bit better than other years, and also reflective of the fact that it's very rare to come to the end of a legislative session having gotten all that you wanted. And, you really see the art of compromise come into play, especially during the conference committee stages when it's not even about the public anymore. It's about the horse trading that goes on. And it's when you have to really keep a close eye on what's going on down there.
And Lele, she was pretty straightforward about some of that horse trading, and in particular regarding the PPPA and what that may mean in terms of getting other parts of what their agenda, what they were hoping to get for the environmental and energy agenda. We'll see how much of it actually lasts a week from Thursday.
Always intriguing at the end of the session, yeah?
Fast-paced and totally frenetic. That's going to do it for us for this Monday. Coming up tomorrow, April is also Donate Life Month, and we're going to take a look at really what the health and well-being of the donor program is in Hawaii right now. We're going to look through the eyes of an RN.
And drama and comedy drawn from the life of Carol Burnett.
You can talk back to your radio. Find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation, and I occasionally tweet at Because HPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back here tomorrow to meet you for more of The Conversation.